Well, here we are back in Corinthians. If you're ever hoping for some exciting surprise when you come to church, you kind of chose the wrong church because you know we're in Corinthians if you were here last week, because we were in Corinthians then, right? And you know we're in chapter 9 this week because last week we finished chapter 8. So occasionally I'll hear that some people will read ahead and they're like, oh, I wanted to see what passage we were in. If you have ever done that, you might think, oh, this one's going to be a unpleasant one or a weird one or an awkward one, because a good portion of this passage is going to be Paul defending his right for the church he's a part of to really support him and take care of him. So you might think, oh, I guess this is Jesse's week to yell at us all to support him. Maybe a little. However, I don't think that's really the main point or the main thrust of this passage. But last week we saw the Apostle Paul, and he was explaining some of the freedoms that we have as Christians. Okay, and it was largely in this kind of context of can Christians eat meat that was sacrificed to these false idols in the temple? And what we saw is Paul basically saying, yeah, you have freedom as a Christian. You have great freedoms to do all kinds of sort of things. Okay, says you have great freedoms. But he ended by warning us very clearly that we need to be careful that we never allow the freedoms that we enjoy and the great liberty that God has allowed to ever get in the way or become a stumbling block, an obstacle to our Christian friends, to our Christian brothers and sisters. Okay, if anything we're going to do, even if you have the freedom to do it, is going to harm another Christian, he said very clearly, you don't get to. So although you might have the right to eat meat sacrificed to an idol, if it's going to cause one of your friends to be confused, you don't get to do it. And right now, if you have never read that passage and you're like, talk about confused, I have no idea. Yeah, sorry, I can't re-explain this odd meat being sacrificed to idols. You'll have to read chapter 8 for yourself. But I am kind of reminding us of it because it's very connected to our passage this week. Okay, he's saying be careful that in the exercise of your freedom, that you don't become a stumbling block to the weak, to those who might have some confusion. He told us that our love and our care and our concern for others will cause us to maybe limit our freedoms. And he's really made that point very clearly last week. But it's almost as if he is anticipating or expecting there to be some kind of questions or some pushback against him. Like, okay, Paul, you say that you'll limit your freedoms for the sake of other people. Why don't you explain how this principle actually works in your own life and in your own ministry? Okay, what does it actually mean for you to limit your freedoms for the sake of others? And he's going to partly answer that for us today. And what's interesting is we're covering 18 verses. We're covering 18 verses. You know how many questions Paul is going to ask in these 18 verses? Depending on what translation you have, if you have a New King James, you're going to see 18 of them. Okay, 18 question marks. 18 different questions. I believe the NIV has 14. Depending on translation, it varies a little bit. But the point is, he's going to ask a ton of questions. And as we see the questions, you'll quickly realize that these are rhetorical questions, meaning he's not really looking for an answer. And also, the assumed answer is clear and simple. And it doesn't require great study to figure out, well, Paul, what is the answer to this question? No, he's asking these questions that have an obvious answer. An obvious answer. So, how does this principle of freedom work itself out in the life of Paul? And we're going to see the first of these questions in the first couple verses, actually the first four questions. So let me start. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 1 says, "Am I not an apostle? Am I not free? Have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? If I am not an apostle to others, yet doubtless I am to you. For you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord." Right, so he starts by saying, "Am I not an apostle?" Well, of course Paul is an apostle. Right? For us, it's like that's part of his title. When we talk about Paul, it's Paul the apostle. It's like, well, yeah, he's an apostle. And just so you're aware, Paul is an apostle. I'm not an apostle. Okay, he reminds them, haven't I seen Jesus? Didn't I see the resurrected Jesus? And I want us to understand that. A little bit of a side note here is that when the Bible speaks of apostles, and my understanding of apostles is very specific, very specific. Because when you go around, you'll meet people who call themselves apostles. Okay, you can search on YouTube. You can find people who say that they're apostles, and they're not. Okay, maybe that is the title they've chosen for their position, but it's not an apostle in the true biblical sense. The apostles were a unique and unrepeatable, meaning there wasn't more after them, group. They were the foundation of the church. And they had a few things in common. Number one is that they had seen Jesus resurrected. Okay, they had seen him after he was resurrected. Number two, they had this divine commission, a mission given to them by Jesus after his resurrection. Okay, I'm not just speaking of the general idea where all of us have been given a mission by God. This was a unique thing. Like Jesus appeared to them. And they were uniquely then gifted and inspired by the Spirit of God in a unique way. Okay, that's who an apostle is. And I just bring that up because I would encourage you to be suspicious of people who go around and give themselves the title of apostle. Okay, you're an apostle, really? Says who? Really, I would be encouraging you to be suspicious of anyone who gives themselves really any spiritual sounding title. Like, you know why I'm a pastor? Not because I decided for myself. I didn't commission myself. I didn't give myself this title. Someone said, "No, you're a pastor now." I was sent by a church, by a group of elders who sent and commissioned and ordained me as a pastor. I even have the certificate to prove it, the real official sheet of paper, because, you know, in the Philippines, nothing's official without a sheet of paper with a stamp. But he says to them, even if other Christians don't think of me as an apostle, this is Paul speaking, others might not consider me an apostle, surely you do in Corinth. Well, why is that? Paul had a unique relationship with the church in Corinth because he started it, right? He had started the church. He had came to that church and he preached the gospel, and the people he's writing to, their lives were changed dramatically because of his life and his ministry. They came to faith in Jesus because of him. He's like, "You knew I was sent here." And then he says, "You are the seal of my apostleship," meaning you guys are my proof. You know, I talked about the stamp. He's like, "You guys are the stamp that proves who I really am. It's your salvation proving who I am." So even if other people might have doubts about Paul, they certainly should not have. They certainly should not have. So he says, the church there in Corinth, who he's writing to, is marked by his seal. So although other people might have these questions about who he is, they shouldn't. And you notice at the very beginning, he is establishing his authority, right? I'm an apostle. I'm sent by God. I have this unique authority. And then verse 3, he says, "My defense to those who examine me is this. my defense to those who examine me is this. And we'll get into what that defense is in a second. But he starts by saying, here, listen up as I defend myself. Here's the defense that I offer to you. Why would someone defend themselves? Because they're under attack, right? You don't defend yourself unless you're under attack, unless you're being critiqued, you're being evaluated. For example, some of you may someday actually have to go and have a defense of your thesis, your project. Some of you I'm not convinced it's ever really going to happen, and you just keep lying to me and saying it's going to happen, and it never actually does. And by some of you, I'm talking about one specific person. But anyways, you know, you've got this, you have to defend this research, this project that you've been working on. And there are people that are going to be examining it, trying to kind of tear it apart and say, there's lots of problems here. Your app doesn't work. Your website has failed. And he says, here's my defense. You've got these attacks. You've got these critiques. Let me answer for them. Here's my defense. What's interesting is the word he gives there for defense and the word he gives for examine. If you want to know the Greek words, defense is apologia. Some of you maybe would recognize that from apologetics, which is kind of the Christian ministry of defending the faith. And then examining is anacrino. Anacrino? I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that right. Anacrino. And the only reason I bring up these Greek words is not so you can learn Greek. It's because the interesting thing is both of those words are legal terms. He's like, this is like a court of law. And here I am defending myself. You're prosecuting me. You're examining me. And I'm defending myself. So he feels as though he's already been kind of found guilty by the Corinthian Christians. And just so you're aware, I don't say this for sympathy. I'm not trying to get you to feel bad for me, but any legitimate spiritual leader is going to have this happen to them. Okay? Any legitimate spiritual leader will have people who are being examined and criticized and watched. Why do people do this? Why do I have to put up with this? Well, there's two reasons. I'm sure we could broaden that out and say there's like a million reasons, but if I'm going to simplify it, there's two reasons. Number one is because the examiners are sincere and right, and they want to make sure they're not being lied to. Okay, there's a lot of spiritual leaders out there today that God has not ordained them for their position. They don't know the Bible. They're manipulating the Bible to lie to people. So you need to be careful. It is appropriate, right, and biblical for you to examine spiritual leaders, including me. Don't just because I say something, you're like, oh, that must be right. That must be true. No, that's part of the reason why we have so many Bibles here in this room is because when I teach, I do want you to have a Bible open. I want you to see, oh, we read that verse. And yeah, that's what it says. He didn't change it. Sometimes I misread something because I'm not that smart, but it's not intentional. I didn't change these verses as I'm reading them. So sometimes these examiners are sincere, they're holy, and they're determined to know the truth. They want to know the truth. That's good. Okay, you have every right, and not only every right, but I would say responsibility to be sure that what you are hearing about God is true. Now, how are you going to do that? Not based on, well, I liked what he said. That's how we are tempted to decide if something is true. Well, I liked it. Who cares? Like, who cares if we like it? When people go to the doctor and they have to take really disgusting medicine, it doesn't matter if you liked it. What matters is, did it work? Did it heal you? Did it fix the issue? Not, was it tasty? So how do we actually do it? We have to know the Bible. Okay, you have to know the Bible. If you don't have a Bible and you would like a Bible, I will get you a Bible. I'll gladly get you a Bible. The church will pay for a Bible for you. And if the church runs out of money, I will get a Bible for you until I run out of money. That would be a great joy for me to use my money to buy you a Bible. So you need to know what it says. You need to know that what I'm saying aren't my thoughts. They're not my opinions, but they're from God's word. It's my job to teach, but you better not just blindly believing every spiritual sounding thing that comes your way. Especially because right now, the rise of internet and all social media and TikTok has given a platform for influencers, spiritual influencers. And you know what? A lot of them don't really care about your maturity and you're close to God and your righteousness and your holiness. They care about if you'll click on it because then they can make more money. And the same could be said, you know, way back in the olden days, like when I was, you know, your age, and people would read Christian books. And a lot of times people didn't even care if it was true. Some of them, I don't even know if they believed the garbage that they wrote, as long as it would sell. So not every Christian book that you read is Christian. Not every sermon you hear is biblical. So examining is good. Examining is right. But be careful that in your study, in your examining, as you are critiquing what I'm saying and looking at what I'm saying and how I'm living, be careful that your pride never leads you into the next reason why people examine and critique. And that is because they don't want to hear the truth. They don't like the truth. So instead, they're going to find a reason for why they don't like the one who is saying it. And if you're looking for it, okay, if you don't like the truth and you don't like the sermons, and you'll find it. Like, you will find something about me. You'll find something about the next church you go to. And it might even be true. I mean, there's stuff about me that's not great. You'll just talk to me. You see, Rodney's known me for a while. He's agreeing. He's like, yeah, just eat dinner with me. You're going to find I can be irritating, I'm sure. So if you want to critique with a prideful, arrogant attitude that hates the truth, you'll find something to hold against a spiritual leader. So be careful that it's not that you just hate the truth and you're looking to defend your position. You don't want the truth taught. You don't want the truth enforced because you like your sin, because you want to stay in darkness. So then you find any excuse to criticize a legitimate church and a legitimate spiritual leader because they don't want to humble themselves and submit to the leadership and teaching that God offers. So he says, this is my defense. I need to defend myself. And then he starts in verse 4 with his defense. Do we have no right to eat and drink? Okay, this is totally unrelated. But when you go and do your defense for school, when you go and you do your defense, you should just read this. Just open up the Bible, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 3. This is my defense. And then read it, and then walk out and see what happens. And then report back to me how it goes. You'll fail your class, but it would be pretty funny. And if you put it on YouTube, maybe you'd get enough clicks to make some money too. I don't know. But he says, this is my defense. First, do we have no right to eat and drink? Do we have no right to take along a believing wife? As do the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord, and Cephas. So again, I'll start by kind of stating the obvious. As Paul defends his role and authority as their leader, it might seem like I'm defending myself as well. I don't know if I am or I'm not. I honestly don't know. What I do know is that it's biblical. So again, I won't apologize if what we read in these next few verses make you feel kind of uncomfortable, like, oh, Jesse's trying to get us to, you know, agree with him or support him or help him. It's very self-serving. Well, I can't apologize. It's the Bible. And as awkward as it might feel for me to teach these passages, like some people are afraid of teaching the verses that we looked at 2 weeks ago, where it's like, hey, you need to stop sleeping with your boyfriend and girlfriend. And that's uncomfortable for them. I don't have any problem saying that. But I do feel weird when we're going to get to these ones like, hey, you guys should financially take care of me. That's awkward for me. But as much as it's awkward, we don't skip verses. We work our way through the Bible, whether it confronts our sinful ideas or just makes us feel awkward. God's word deserves to be taught. It deserves to be heard. All of it. So he starts with a right to eat and drink. That seems kind of weird. Like, have any of you ever had to fight? Like, hey, I get a snack too. It's not fair. Well, there's two kind of ways where this is relevant to what Paul's saying here. Number one, if you remember last week, we were talking about the freedom to eat things that some people would say you couldn't eat. Like the Jews, they wouldn't eat pork, but Christians got to eat pork. So there were all these different rules and all these regulations. And he's saying, oh, don't I have the freedom to have these things? Evidently, there were people that were saying, Paul, we don't like what you're eating. We don't like what you're drinking. This isn't okay. You know, they're checking to see what's in his cup. Well, they're checking, you know, looking out in his trash bins, seeing, well, what did he throw in there? And this happens. It actually does. But there's another way, and I think the next is more clearly what he's saying. He's saying, I have a right to eat and drink. Like, I need to be able to feed myself. Like, I need enough money to buy some rice. Okay, and I say that because he's going to go on to kind of cover that. And he's going to say that this support that he should have, the support for the apostles and for Barnabas and for other leaders, should also extend to their wives if they have them. Paul was single, but he's also speaking for Barnabas. He's also speaking for other apostles. And he says, don't we have a right to bring our wife with? Like, shouldn't she be taken care of as well? And that seems like such a quick sentence. Like, don't I have a right to bring my believing wife? And yet I think there's at least three important things for us to learn here. Number one, even in just quick passing, he adds the word believing. Because Paul is going to take every opportunity, and so will I, to press upon you that if you're a Christian, your spouse, the person you might pursue to be your spouse, is to be a believer. Right? Even here, it's just a passing comment, and he adds believing. Christians marry Christians. We covered that already. It's a sin not to. And I'll tell you that as you look into this, you can biblically support that that goes for any pursuit of marriage as well. Because I've had people who would tell me, I know I'm supposed to marry a believer, but we're just dating. And they'll say that their dating is evangelism, and they're trying to date that person into Christianity. Well, first of all, you're in sin, so I don't think your example is going to be greatly effective in your evangelism. Secondly, you are still partnering yourself, or what the Bible calls yoking yourself, to an unbeliever. So that's just stupid. That's just stupid. And if I'm insulting you right now, you're like, hey, I'm doing that. He's being a jerk. I'm sorry, but it's what the Bible says. And I would gladly talk to you about it in a long conversation with more patience and explanation than just calling you stupid. But right now, that's all I have time to say. It's dumb. And I say that because I care about you. I care. And I don't want you to enter into a mess. So that's the first thing in this comment of, don't we have a right to bring a wife? The second one, many of the apostles, when they traveled, they brought their wife with them. And I bring that up because ministry wasn't just for the husbands to go off to do, and then the wife was left at home with nothing to do. They were partnered in this. And that's how it should be. Ministry, you're together. You're serving the Lord together. And I'm not saying it's wrong for people to ever, you know, be in different places. Like, is every missionary that's ever left their wife at home or left their husband at home in sin? No, I'm not saying that. But I'm saying if we're to be united serving the Lord together, I think it's an appropriate thing for that to actually happen. And that's why you'll notice, like, when we have teams come from America, if they're married, almost, maybe not 100% of the time, but 99% of the time, they come together. And here he's saying the support should be together. So I was sent here, and Chelsea was sent here. Our church supports both of us here. The support isn't just for one or the other. So ministry should be combined. Okay? There's different roles, different responsibilities. But if you want to serve God and you want to get married, you better find someone who wants to be in this together. And then the third thing, he says, don't we have a right to bring our wife along? And then he explains, like some other people do. Well, who's these other people that he says get to bring their wife with? Number one is Cephas. Okay, does anyone know who Cephas is? Cephas is the Apostle Peter. And it's very clear. You can find that. Bible is clear. This is Peter. So Peter got to bring his wife. This is really basic, but if Peter got to bring his wife, you know what that means? It means Peter was married. Right? If you have a wife, it means you're married. So Peter was married. And at this point, you might be thinking like, this, yeah, okay. Well, why would I bring this up? Well, because somewhere along the way, this idea that marriage was not holy or right in service to ministry came along, right? That celibacy, not being married, is somehow required for effective ministry was introduced. And that idea isn't just unhelpful, but it's anti-biblical. It's anti-biblical. And you need to know that somehow between the time of Peter, who the church thinks is a pretty important guy, kind of like a foundation cornerstone, sometime between him having a wife, serving the Lord, being effective, and then about 300 years later, there was a guy, and I can't pronounce his name, but Syricus? Let me find the spelling so that I at least kind of get it sort of close. Do any of you know? Holler it out if you know how to pronounce Syricus's name. Syricus. Yeah, we're going to call him Syricus. Syricus. Who's he? Well, he was a pope about 300 years later, and he said this. He defined marriage as an uncleanness in which no one can really please God. An uncleanness that no one can really please God in, which, wait a minute, what about Peter? Someone forgot to tell Peter, because I kind of think Peter lived and pleased the Lord. So I'm confused. And just to make this as obvious as possible, in case you don't understand, people say Peter was the first pope, and yet then they say that people that are, you know, really effective in ministry can't be married. How does that work? It doesn't. So this one verse kind of destroys that idea. And then more in this verse destroys other teaching that is common in the Catholic Church, and that is, who else gets to bring their wife besides Peter? The brothers of Jesus. The brothers of Jesus. Wait a minute. Jesus had brothers? Yeah. At least four of them. And we're not talking about Christian brothers like we're Jesus' brother. We're adopted into the family. No, we're talking Mary had other kids. Mary didn't remain a virgin. That's a lie. We know their names. One's name is Joseph or Joseph. We don't know much about him. One is James. Pretty important guy. Becomes a leader of the church in Jerusalem. Simon, very little known about him. Jude, the author, maybe, of the book of Jude. And then he even had sisters. Okay, had sisters. We don't know their names, but it's plural in both Matthew 13 and Mark 6. So there's at least two. Plural means at least two. So that's at least six siblings that Jesus had. So again, you better be careful about believing things that people lie to you about, because when you study the Bible, you find that some things that you always believed were true, the Bible doesn't support. Verse 6, so after this, he continues on. Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working? So basically he's like, so everyone else gets to be supported, but I guess Barnabas and I don't get to be supported. And here he's going to really directly deal with a somewhat dangerous topic, a somewhat controversial topic, and that is the financial and physical support for him as their spiritual leader. And this is a topic that has been greatly divisive, that's been greatly abused, and cause great confusion to many. Okay, when you read Paul's life and his ministry, you find that many times he did not receive pastoral support. Okay, he didn't receive kind of financial support, and he didn't accept it and didn't want it. It records how he would work a secular job He was a tent maker. Okay, he would make tents, and then he would sell those tents to earn a living so that he could keep on ministering and serving the Lord. So that's what he did. And although he did that many times, that doesn't make his point here of support any less valid. Okay, for me, I became a pastor in 2018. I might be lying to you, but it's close enough for the point of the story. I think it's 2018. And for years, a couple of years before that, and then after for a while as well, I served God at my church just however I had time, when I had time, nights and weekends. I had no support. You guys are running away. You're trying to be sneaky, but it's just not working. So I had no support, and I never really expected to get any support. I remember when the church finally got to a point where it could partially support me, and I worked like 2 days a week for the church. I was just shocked. I was like, I'm going to get paid? Like, you're going to provide for me to serve God? I was shocked. I never expected it. And there's nothing wrong with pastors working to support themselves. Paul did it, right? Paul did it. So there's nothing wrong with that. And I bring that up because here in the Philippines, some people would say that, well, that's not scriptural. I've heard people say, well, that pastor must not live by faith. Like, he has a job. That's not living by faith. Don't you know of all those crazy stories of missionaries that they didn't work, they never had support, and God just miraculously provided for them? Well, again, it didn't work for Paul. Paul sold tents to support himself sometimes. He had to do it. So a pastor working a job isn't a lack of faith. It's not inappropriate. It's not wrong. And yet, what he's going to say here, the fact that a pastor may or could, or a spiritual leader of any kind could work, doesn't mean that the church doesn't have a responsibility. So Paul's example shows his freedom, but what it doesn't do is give an excuse for us to ignore these verses. So he goes on to defend this point of view in verse 7. He says, Whoever goes to war at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its fruit? Or who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk of that flock? So basically he's saying, like, think this through. Does a soldier have to buy his own supplies? Like, imagine you get enlisted into the army and you go, I don't know how it works here, but you go and there's an office and they say, okay, great, you signed up. Now why don't you head out to the store, buy yourself some army boots, get yourself a uniform, go buy a tank, get a gun, bring your fighter jet, and then we'll put you to work. Know that stuff's kind of provided. Like, oh, you're willing to fight? You're willing to give your life? We'll get you a pair of boots. We'll get you a gun. We'll take care of you. And he says the farmer, right, if you have a vineyard, the idea here is the fruit farmer, after he grows all of his stuff, he doesn't have to go to the market to buy back his fruit. Like, he takes the fruit before, doesn't have to go back. The shepherd, those who have animals, they're going to provide for themselves from those animals. Like, nobody would really argue that. So he says, my reason for establishing this as ministers is it's just kind of keeping with common practice in all other areas of life. So if it's so natural, why would it be so wrong, or who would be so unjust to not offer that same for a minister, a servant of God? Verse 8, he says, do I say these things as a mere man, or does not the law say the same also? So he wants to make it clear, this isn't just my idea. It's not like I'm just trying to take from you, but this is actually a biblical principle. He explains that in verse 9, for it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Is it oxen that God is concerned about? Or does he say it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt this is written, that he who plows should plow in hope, and he who threshes in hope should be a partaker of his hope. So in Deuteronomy chapter 25, verse 4, God commanded, "You shall not muzzle, put a cover over the mouth of an ox while it treads the grain." So how this would happen back then is when the grain needed to be processed, they would use an ox, a large animal, to carry, to roll a stone, a wheel over the grain to break it open. Okay, and he says you wouldn't cover that animal's mouth so that it can't eat of its grain as it's going. Now, as long as I've distracted us totally on other points, I'll do it again. I don't know how this works, because if you ever follow animals, they're not real clean about where the food comes out of their body. So I think this grain would have been kind of gross. But that's how it works, right? They would drag this stone over, but it would get to eat as it went. They wouldn't cover up its mouth. And then he says, do you really think that God wrote this just for the oxen? Like, you think that's what God was so concerned with? He says, maybe this is actually for us. Then he says, certainly, this is for us. Paul says it's not oxen that are the focus of God's word. There's a Bible commentator named Warren Wiersbe. It's kind of an odd name, but he says this, and I think it's interesting. He says, since oxen cannot read, this verse was probably not written for them. Since oxen cannot read, this verse was probably not written for them. So it would be cruel to starve those who are providing and preparing your food. Right? Imagine you have someone preparing your food and you starve them as they're doing it. That would be cruel. That would be unfair. In verse 11, he says, if we have sown spiritual things for you, is it really a great thing if we reap your material things? So here he's emphasizing that something that's really significantly valuable isn't physical things, but spiritual things. Meaning if you've received from him spiritually, you should have no problem providing for him physically. Right? Because the spiritual is far more valuable. And I understand this because there are a few men in my life who are incredibly influential. Okay, I know God and I know the Bible largely through their ministry. And I could never pay them back. Like the spiritual gain that I got from them, I'd never be able to repay with any amount of money. You know, I could bring them snacks for forever. Bring them the best food that you can find. And it's not going to cover it. Like if I've gained from them spiritually, then who cares about physically? Because for Paul, and really for any Christian who understands God and has been redeemed by Christ, we understand that the physical isn't that important, but it's the spiritual that matters. Verse 12, if others are partakers of this right over you, are we not even more? So he says, if other people have kind of taken from you, we should even more. He's like, I started this church. I deserve this. That's what he's saying. Again, might seem kind of uncomfortable for you. And it's like, I started this church. I deserve this. Just wait. Because the next point, he says, nevertheless, we have not used this right, but we endure all things, lest we hinder the gospel of Christ. So after all of that, you kind of expect him to say after all of that, therefore, it's time for you to start taking care of me. Like, I've just proven it. It's time for you to take care of me. But that's not what he does. He says, nevertheless, I've never taken that. I've never exercised that right because I do not want to hinder or prevent the work of the gospel. So he has not, he still is not asking because for him, the work of the gospel is more important. And we're going to come back to verse 12 in a second. But verse 13 says, do you not know that those who minister the holy things eat of the things of the temple? So, right, the Jewish people, we talked about this with other priests last week, but they would get to eat, they would really get a living from what was happening in the temple. It says that those who serve at the altar, they partake of the offerings of the altar. Even so, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should live from the gospel. So here's the problem. Here's the problem with these verses, is that many greedy, self-appointed ministers have abused these verses for their own selfish, self-centered gain. Okay, and it happens all around the world where people will point to these verses and they'll say, you know, you got to take care of me. You're supposed to tithe. You're supposed to support me. And in America, you just watch it on the TV pastors. I'm not saying that there aren't good pastors on TV, but there's kind of a broad category of TV pastors that are no pastors at all. They're just celebrities looking for money. And they con people by saying, if you will send me this money, God's going to return it to you tenfold. Okay, maybe that happens here. I got to do my research and find who the greatest culprit of that is here in the Philippines. So this is a problem, and people manipulate and they twist these verses, and therefore it makes it difficult to avoid the appearance of being self-serving. Okay, the people of the church should faithfully support the ministry of the church in all ways. The people of the church should faithfully support the ministry of the church. And one of those ways is financially. And I don't say this for my own benefit. I say it because it's biblical. And the nice thing is, just so you know, the way we're set up, if you want to faithfully support the work of this church, I'm not going to make any more money because of that. That's not how this works. Paul says, even so, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should live from the gospel. In other words, financial support for ministers isn't just kind of a human invention, but it's God's design. It's not a human invention, but it's God's design. However, that doesn't mean that all such servants of God must take that support, right? Paul many times didn't. But it doesn't mean that the church is doing something worldly or unbiblical when it provides it. And maybe this is irrelevant to all but me, I don't know. If any of you should ever pursue leadership in the church, you know how you know if and when you can or should receive support from the church? Whatever best for the kingdom of God. There came a point where there was so much work to be done in our church. There were so many opportunities to minister where the gospel was going to be furthered by me taking the support. So how do you decide whatever's best for the kingdom of God? Nowhere in that decision comes what is best for you. And if any leader, any servant of God does receive support, the Bible expects them to work hard. Okay, another Bible commentator wrote this: if someone who does not labor, meaning someone does not work hard in the ministry, takes his support from the church of God, this is not just theft, but sacrilege. He's saying this is a big deal. This is bad. He says the one who devotes himself to this work has a right to support for himself and his family, but the one who takes more than he needs is a covetous hireling, and the one who does nothing for the cause of God, yet demands the church fund his idleness, is a kind of monster that we do not have the language to describe. So he's saying if someone's going to take from the church, not so they can serve the Lord diligently, but just so that they can be lazy. Someone's going to take the church not because they want to commit their lives to the church or to the ministry of God to further his kingdom, to accomplish God's purposes, and yet they're taking the support. He says we don't even have a word to describe how evil that is. Okay, pastors should work hard. They should work hard. They should be busy. And if they don't have stuff to do, they should go get a job. Like a pastor who's doing nothing all week long but preparing one sermon, doesn't meet with people, doesn't, I don't know why they would expect a salary. They should work hard. They should be busy about the serving of God. Okay, verse 15, but I have used none of these things. So he's kind of repeating what he said in verse 12. I have used none of these things, nor have I written these things that it should be done so for me. So not only does he say, I've never yet received those things, he's saying, and I'm not writing about it now to get you to start offering it. I'm not writing about this now to get you to start offering it. He's saying, I'm not trying to convince you guys. I'm not asking. And frankly, he's saying, I'm not even accepting. So having defended his right to be supported by the church, he now makes it clear that he does not do this ministry for his own benefit. Right, the second half of that verse, I have not written these things so that it should be done for me, for it would be better for me to die than anyone should make my boasting void. Okay, I'll explain that in a second. But the point is, he's not so concerned about his own comfort, his own benefit. He's concerned with what's going to bring glory to God. So he's trying to draw a clear picture that just because he could demand this of them, he's not doing that because he wants what's best for the kingdom of God. He wants to serve the Lord. So his perspective is actually that he would gladly let go of his rights for the sake of the gospel of Jesus. He would gladly let go of his rights for the sake of God and God's kingdom. We're going to see that it repeated next week. Not next week, because Ryan will be here. But eventually, when we get back to our study in Corinthians. We're going to see that in verse 23. He says, everything I do is for the sake of the gospel. My whole life is all lived out for the sake of God's kingdom. So his perspective is that he would gladly let go of his rights. And that's really crazy because we live in a time where we all want to fight for our rights, right? We demand our rights. We protest for our rights. We say, this is what you owe me. And Paul says, well, I'd gladly give my rights up if it's good for God, if it's good for his people, if it will further his mission, I would gladly give them up. And we can understand why he would be willing to do such a thing and how he could have that kind of crazy perspective as we read the final few verses of our passage, verse 16. For if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yes, woe is me if I do not preach the gospel, for I do this willingly. If I do this willingly, I have a reward. But if against my will, I have been entrusted with a stewardship. What is my reward then? When I preach the gospel, I may present the gospel of Christ without charge, that I may not abuse my authority in the gospel. So this kind of shifts this here between verse 15 and 16 seems a little abrupt and a little confusing, but his point is actually pretty simple. Verse 15, he says he would rather die than lose the one thing that he can genuinely boast about. Okay, and he's not saying boast about in a proud way, but in a joyful way. And what is that? That he preaches the gospel without demanding his rights. Because otherwise, that'd be a job. Right? If I was here, because it's like, I'm here because all the money I make, I would lose the joy in this. I would lose the whole purpose behind it. In verse 16, he explains why he doesn't even see this preaching as something to brag about. He says that necessity is laid upon him. Necessity is laid upon him. Woe is me if I do not do it. He's saying, I'm compelled. I've got to do this, right? If there is necessity laid upon you, it's not an option, right? He's got to do this. So some of you are involved in ministry. Some of you are involved in serving God. And some of you do it very clearly through this church, and we might call ourselves volunteers. Like, oh, you're not getting a paycheck, so you're a volunteer, right? Some of you volunteer here. And that's true. Like, no one's forcing you to do it. You're choosing to do it. But there's another way to look at it that I hope is also kind of true. Like Paul, you're not really a volunteer because necessity is laid upon you. It's like, no, I've got to do this. He says, woe is me if I don't. It's like, I've got to preach the gospel. I hope you feel that way about your service to God. Okay, I'm not specifically saying making rice here. Like, woe is me if I don't get to make the rice. I'm saying I hope that you live that way where you're surrendered to God and you're like, I've got to do it. I have to. Paul didn't seem to see himself as a volunteer. He had to do this. He could not possibly not do this. Hope I didn't lose you there. He could not possibly not do this. He had to live for Christ. And this is a pretty unusual perspective on serving God, and yet it's a biblical one. It's one that understands 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 14, that says, the love of Christ compels me. Compels me. I hope you are compelled by the love of Christ to serve him with all of your life. One example of this as we're closing, in Jeremiah, kind of an odd Old Testament book, but in Jeremiah, you can listen to what he has to say. It's in chapter 20, but he's kind of complaining at this point. That Jeremiah does a lot of that. He's kind of known actually at times as the wailing prophet, like the crying prophet. So he's whining, he's complaining. In verse 8, he says, whenever I speak, I cry out proclaiming violence and destruction. He's like, every time that God has me talk, I got to say all this terrible stuff, and there's going to be destruction and judgment. And he says, this is dreadful, this is terrible. I don't want to do it anymore. Every time I go to preach, the word that God has brought to me doesn't bring me friends, doesn't bring me people who are on my side, but it brings me haters and insulters. He's like, when I do what God's told me to do, it's not a lot of fun for me. So you would think he would say, well, I guess I'm done. And he kind of does. So he says, I'm done. I'm going to stop it. I'm not going to speak anymore. But then at the end of that, he says, but if I say I'm not going to mention him or speak of him anymore or speak in his name, his word in my heart is like a fire that is shut up in my bones. Indeed, I am weary of holding it in. Indeed, I cannot hold it in. This is the prophet Jeremiah saying, every time I have to preach, it's not a lot of fun. I don't really want to do it. There's more fun I could have. I could skip church on Sunday. I could go do something else. And every time I do it, people critique me and they don't like it and they've all got their opinions and it doesn't bring me any more friends. He says, so I'm just done with it. But then he says, and then when I try to be done, when I try to just stop doing what God has called me to do, what he has impressed upon me to do, what he has compelled me to do, I can't contain it. I just have to. I have to. And I hope that's how you are serving God. Not out of misery and like, oh, I don't want to do this, but I hope you have to. You love Christ. His love for you compels you. You can't not. You can't not. And I kind of understand this. I think this is the right attitude for people who encounter the love of Christ, right? Compelled to surrender, doing it gladly, even letting go of your rights and your freedoms. Paul understood this. That's why he said in Galatians 2:20, it's not him who lives anymore, but Christ who lives in him. It was necessary. It wasn't optional. He says, if I were doing this on my own, like if I had dreamed this up, if I had come up with this plan, this fun little plan, it wouldn't mean very much. And I understand that, at least in part. Okay, I can tell you that I didn't become a pastor because it's like, this looks like fun. Like, you go to a job fair when you're in high school. It's like firefighter, accountant, engineer, pastor. Oh, that looks like a good one. Okay, that's not how I ended up here. Not at all. No, how did I end up here? Because I had to. Why? Because God called me. God called me. He impressed it upon me. Okay? I do this because I can't not. I do this because God called me. I do this because my church commissioned me, and here I am. Not with complaints. I hope I'm not like Jeremiah, you know, the wailing prophet. I hope that's not how I'm remembered. Not as if I'm forced, but I do it out of compulsion by the love of Christ. The love of Christ compels me. I've got to serve him. I have to. I hope you do too. I pray that you do as well. And that's our reward. That's what he says. That's our reward. What's fun for me, the reward I get, isn't your financial support. The reward that I get is that I get to serve the King. That's our reward.